Okay, so more about how we prove mechanisms by disproving mechanisms. Okay, we talked about stereochemistry, the fact that you get inversion of configuration on a certain class of nucleophilic substitution reactions. We'll see others where you don't, so the mechanism is different. Rate law, we saw last time, the dependence on concentration, and we started on rate constant, looking at how the substrate structure, R, affected the rate constant. Now we'll look at how the nucleophile affects the rate constant, the nature of the nucleophile. So these are relative rates for generic SN2 substitution reactions. Compared to the rate reacting with just water. So all these anions are better than water. Not too surprisingly, they have higher HOMOs. So they'll bond better to the sigma star. But let's compare these rates. That is the rate for, it has to do with the energy of forming the transition state, bonding with sigma star, with what you get for bonding to hydrogen at equilibrium, the pKa. So if you look at oxygen, fluorine, and the anion of oxygen, all in the first row, you can see that there's a good correlation. The things that stick more tightly to a proton, for example, hydroxide sticks more tightly to a proton than water does, are also faster in the rate of the reaction. Of course, the rate isn't as drastically different as the equilibrium constant because you haven't completely formed the bond as you do in the case of the equilibrium constant. So there's a difference of 10 to the 18th, 10 to the 17 and a half for binding to a proton, but a difference of only 16,000 for the rate of nucleophilic substitution. This, of course, the correlation isn't surprising. They both require an unusually high HOMO of the nucleophile. Okay, but here's something that's a little bit more surprising. Notice that as we go down this series, as we get weaker at bonding to a proton, we get better at doing the nucleophilic substitution reaction. Or here again, when we go from hydroxide to the sulfur analog, the sulfur analog is a weaker base. The H plus form is a better acid by 8 orders of magnitude, almost 9. But it's worse at bonding to a proton, but it's better at doing the nucleophilic substitution. And this has to do with, you notice what we're doing now is going from row to row in the periodic table. So the orbitals are getting much better. So as they get much bigger, pardon me. So as they get, the bigger atoms have a better time attacking the sigma star than you would expect, depending on compared to how they attack the proton. In part of that, it's because they have better overlap. But that's not all that is, the smaller ones have better overlap with hydrogen. But that's not all there is to it, because the solvent also enters in. So if you look at the reaction in water, the nucleophilic substitution with methyl iodide, and compare chloride, bromide, iodide, you see that it's more or less like the generic ratios given here. 1, 14, this is 10, 160, this is 80, right? So it gets faster as you get. That is, iodide is a better nucleophile than bromide, is a better nucleophile than chloride, even though iodide doesn't hold a proton as strongly. Right. However, if you change solvent and go to acetone, then the order is the sensible one. The one that's a stronger base, chloride, is also faster. Right? So notice it's completely turned over as you change the solvent. And the relevant difference between water and acetone is that acetone is called an aprotic solvent. It's not that it doesn't have protons. Everything has protons. And acetone even has hydrogens, but they're not acidic hydrogens. They're not OH hydrogens. The water is a protic solvent like alcohols are. It has OH groups. So what's special about OH groups as compared to solvents that don't have OH groups? What can that kind of solvent do, ones that have OHs? They can do hydrogen bonding. And that stabilizes the anions, right? Get the plus of the hydrogen near the minus of the anion. But if you want to then use the anion to do a nucleophilic substitution, you have to break the hydrogen bond first to get it up there where it's going to react. Okay? So if you've already stabilized the anion, then it's harder to get to the transition state. So one of the main reasons for this inversion, it seems, is not just the size of the orbitals that's involved, but how much they're hydrogen bonded. Because the small chloride is very strongly hydrogen bonded and therefore very slow when you have it in water. Whereas iodide, the big ion, isn't attacked so much by water. So the water's easier to remove and the reaction goes 200 times faster. Whereas if you don't have hydrogen bond, it's the sensible orientation, the pKa's parallel the rate of reaction as you would expect. Okay? So it's harder to break H bonds to smaller ions. Okay? Now, in general, polar solvents accelerate reactions that generate charge. So if your starting material is uncharged and the transition state is developing charge, then having a polar solvent stabilizes the transition state by that mechanism more than it does the ground state. So it lowers the transition state and makes the reaction easier. Exactly the contrary, if you have something that's forming that's destroying charge as you approach the transition state, so two ions coming together, for example, so that charge is going away, then the starting material is stabilized more than the transition state and the reaction will get slower. So you can probe sometimes the charge nature of what's changing, whether charge is concentrating or dispersing, on the basis of how good the solvent is at stabilizing charges. Derek? Pardon me?
One of the reactions, the one where it creates ions.
Yeah.
Used in an aproteic solvent to accelerate it.
Yeah, it's not so much there are two aspects of the solvent. Really, they're the same, or sort of the same. It's how well they stabilize ions. But there are two ways you can think of them stabilizing ions. They can just be general dipolar, like acetone is dipolar, right? So that can, the molecules can orient and stabilize and charge, right? Or they can be protic, which means they're polar, but specifically they have OH groups in them, right? Or actually FH or something like that would be the same. But a really polar bond to hydrogen. Of course, they're polar, the same as the others, so they stabilize ions. Right, but what's special about the OH dipole compared to just generic dipoles like the one in acetone? Why is it so much better at stabilizing ions, the OH? It's because the hydrogen's so small. Right, you can get really close to the ion and do a really special job of stabilizing it. Right? And in fact, that's so much better that it's given a separate name, hydrogen bonding, even though in both cases it's not covalent bonding at all. It's just dipoles. But when you have OH, then you can get really close. Right? So solvents are characterized by two terms. How big their dipole moment is, that's, for example, if you put a negative and a positive sheet and see what the capacitance of the thing is, how the molecules could line up to lower the field in between. That doesn't depend on how close they get to anything else. It's just how dipolar they are. That's the dielectric constant, right? Which is relevant. But if the solvent is also protic, then it can do an especially good job at getting close to an ion to stabilize it. So you have things. So acetone would be called a dipolar aprotic solvent, right? So it's good for it's dipolar, but it's also not protic, so it doesn't do the specially good job at stabilizing small anions, which water does, which is what makes chlorides fast, slower here and faster there.
So it accelerates reaction because it lowers the energy of the leaving group.
If you were creating charge, right, then you'd want stable things that stabilize charge, hydrogen bonding stuff. If you're destroying charge in the transition state or dispersing it, making the ion much bigger, then it's just the opposite. Things that stabilize charge will stabilize the starting material more than the transition state. Okay. Now, how about the leaving group? Well, this section 7.4e in the book gives this table, which says characterizes the leaving groups as good, bad, very good. Okay, it doesn't give specific numbers. But we can compare them with pKa's. And what we see now is that there's really good parallelism between for these nucleophilic substitution reactions to the various leaving groups. The ones that are very good are ones that are very acidic. So if you got a stable anion, right, then you get a good, it becomes a good leaving group. It's good at forming the anion as a leaving group. And if you have something that's not a good stable anion, something that holds strongly to protons, then it holds strongly to carbon as well, and it's a bad leaving group. Okay, nothing surprising there. So weak bases are good leaving groups, H like R, as expected. That is, bonding to H is like bonding to R. So that ROH, breaking the OH, is very bad because you're trying to form OH minus. But if you protonated the alcohol, then you're losing water, right? Which is a very weak base. H3O plus is a very strong acid. So what's a bad leaving group becomes a good leaving group just by virtue of having acid in there. So that's acid catalysis of the FnSn2 reaction. And if you have another anion like this one, which is the anion of a strong acid, a sulfonic acid as it's called, then again, that's a very good leaving group. And remember, that's what Kenyon and Phillips did in order to do their SN2 reaction when they wanted to see whether an SN2 reaction inverts an alcohol or not. They couldn't do the alcohol, but they made it into a sulfonate ester. Now, just to underline a few of the examples given in the book. These are all in the book, so you don't need them from here. But there are various tricks in section 7.4f for making alcohols into good substrates, that is, to make the leaving group good. One is the one we just talked about, put a proton on. So if you react with HBr, you protonate, you got a good leaving group, and you can do a substitution converting here ethyl bromide into ethyl alcohol into ethyl bromide. By the same token, and you can see that it's what you expect for the pKa, is about 16 for hydroxide and minus 1.7 for water as a base. You can do the same thing with ethers. You think of using ethers as a solvent, and they're not being reactive, but they can react if you react with a special reagent like HBr. So here HBr reacts to convert the diethyl ether into ethyl bromide and ethanol. And the trick is not only that you make it into a good leaving group by protonating, but the anion of the acid, it's a strong acid, so it'll protonate, but it also happens to be an anion that's a good nucleophile, right? So it's good at bonding, bad at bonding to hydrogen, strong acid, good at bonding to carbon, right, in the transition state, a good nucleophile. You put these two things together and the ether becomes a reactant instead of a solvent. Or you can convert the OH into OSO2R, and this, as I just said, was what Kenyon and Phillips talked about, and here's the reaction. And remember, the beginning of that is to do this reaction to form the sulfonate from the alcohol, and that, remember, is a substitution at sulfur, where the oxygen attacks sulfur, and then chloride leaves, And as I mentioned last time, because sulfur is further down in the periodic table, it has vacant orbitals that allow it to form a new, an extra bond, right? So you can form an intermediate with an extra bond and then lose the chloride. So it's an association first and then dissociation, not like the carbon reaction we're talking about, which does both of them simultaneously. But we'll talk about that a little more in a second. Okay, and the tosylate has a pKa of -3, as we just mentioned previously. Okay, or a very common reagent has OSOCl is what's formed. You react with what's called thionyl chloride, a liquid which reacts very readily, and it's the same kind of thing where O attacks the sulfur to get a higher valent sulfur, and then chloride leaves. So you get... the mechanism is... what I was going to mention first is that the neat thing about this reaction is you add this liquid and it reacts to form these two things, which are both gases, right? So there's no byproduct to the solvent. That is, there's nothing else in the solution. It's very easy to purify afterwards because all you have is your alkyl halide. The other products disappeared. So here's the... So you react, as I said, the oxygen attacks sulfur, then chloride leaves, which gives you this. So you have the OSOCl that we're talking about. And now you have this as a good leaving group. But it's a good leaving group for a special reason. As the chloride attacks and these electrons go here, these electrons can go here at the same time. So you generate SO2 and chloride. And in fact, it's possible for this to happen like this without the nucleophile's participation. And we'll talk. That's a different kind of reaction that we'll talk about shortly, probably next lecture. Okay, or it can be phosphorus that's the special reagent, like PBr3. So the oxygen attacks the phosphorus, forms a higher valent intermediate, bromide leaves, and now you have OPBr2 as the leaving group, right? And the bromide attacks and you get this. Now it shows as the product POH3 because it can happen again and again with the other two bromines that are on the phosphorus. So in subsequent steps of the reaction of the what was originally PBr3, this X isn't bromine anymore. It becomes OH. Okay, and here's an example of PCl5. So bromine or chlorine converts that to the chloride. Okay, let me just pause on that a second to say, there's something funny about doing this by an SN2 reaction, displacing this, which has been activated by putting phosphorus on it, so it's a good leaving group, but having chloride come in to form that product. Can anybody see what it is that's really funny about that? There was someone who asked the other day a similar thing. Who was it that asked this? It was about cyclopropyl chloride, why it might be slow. Who was it that, yeah, why did you say, Brian? It wasn't you? Does somebody remember when I was asking why cyclopropyl chloride should be slow? Somebody suggested that it was hard for the nucleophile to attack sigma star because it's in the wrong place. Right? Because if you wanted to attack sigma star here, which is big here, that's right inside this cage of carbon atoms. You can't come in here to attack it. Right? So in this case, it must be that the leaving group first leaves to form the cation, and then the nucleophile attacks. So it's a different kind of reaction to form that. Okay, now, or it can be OP plus. Which will be a very good leaving group. And that one's done by this special trick using triphenylphosphine. So you prepare the reagent by reacting with carbon tetrachloride, just the nucleophilic substitution at chlorine, and you get phenyl-3P+ chloride and the CCl3 anion. But now, again, phosphorus can make more bonds because it has d orbitals, so the oxygen can attack there. and then the chloride can leave and you get this thing. And now you have this super leaving group here. Phenyl-3-PO, this one. That turns out to be a fantastically strong bond. This is a very stable molecule, so it's a great leaving group. So that's a good way of making alcohols in high yield. And notice again that it's a two-stage reaction. First the oxygen attacks, so it's an association, and then the chloride leaves, dissociation. Okay. And here's a specific example of getting a high yield of this chloride by doing that, reacting with those reagents. Now, here's an example that I took from the textbook we used in the course last year from Loudon, who's a professor at Purdue. But he's actually in pharmaceutical sciences is his department. So he's very interested in applications of organic chemistry. And I thought this was a really cute application and one that you might enjoy. So it's an example of where you have to try to maximize the speed of a nucleophilic substitution reaction by changing the kind of parameters we've been talking about. And the reason is to support what's called PET scanning, positron emission tomography scanning. The way it works is if you have a positron, which is a positive electron, that is, you can generate a positron by a nuclear reaction of fluorine, which gives off this crazy particle, antiparticle, positron, with a half-life of 110 minutes. Right? Now, where do you get this fluorine-18? You get it by having an highly accelerated proton collide with oxygen-18. So the proton comes in, the neutron comes out, and you get, so losing a neutron from here and adding a proton gets you one over on the periodic table to this, okay, but you haven't changed the mass because a proton came in and a neutron came out. But oxygen 18 was quite stable, although a little bit expensive. But now you've got this thing, which has a half-life of 110 minutes and will give off positrons. Now, what do you want positrons for? You know, antiparticles annihilate if they collide with normal particles. So if you have a regular electron, of which you have a zillion, you generate two gamma rays, which fly apart in exactly opposite directions. Now, if you surround this sample with a detector that responds when a positron hits it, you know that the place that positron was formed, because there are electrons all around, the positron takes no time whatever to annihilate. So wherever you form it is where it reacts. Okay? But if these two things went anti-parallel to one another, that fluoride that did that fluorine 18, must have been someplace along this line that connects them. Okay? But now, if you have a bunch of those fluorines in the same place, then you'll get other examples of decomposition, like, for example, those two coming out at the same time, or those two coming out at the same time. And then if you connect all the lines in three dimensions, they'll intersect where the fluorine was. Okay, so you can find out where that fluorine is. Now, if you wanted to use it to detect cancer, you'd have to get fluorine where the cancer is. If you could concentrate fluorine 18 where cancer is, then you can use this trick to find out where the cancer is. Okay? And you can read a little bit about this in Wikipedia if you want to. The hook is that you have to do this within a couple hours, because 110 minutes is 2 hours. This stuff is going away all the time. So you need a high energy accelerator for protons in order to generate fluoride. But then you have to change the fluoride into something chemically and have that something go where the tumor is. And you have to do this all in a couple hours. So it's crucial that you do the reactions rapidly, that you do everything rapidly, including the chemical reactions. Now, you can use other nuclides too in this. You can use carbon-11 or nitrogen-13 or oxygen-15, but those are even shorter half-lives, so you really have to operate quickly. Now, it turns out that if you go to the Yale Pet Center webpage, you can find out what facilities they have in the hospital, and they have a cyclotron. In fact, the cyclotron could have been invented at Yale. It wasn't. It was invented by E.O. Lawrence, who was a graduate student in physics here, and a faculty member. He was an assistant professor from 1923 to 1928, something like that. And he invented the cyclotron in 1930, because in 1928, Berkeley hired him away, telling him that if he went there, he could have graduate students that would help him. He would be an associate professor, and he wouldn't have to teach as much. Incidentally, that's the same reason that Rutherford didn't come to Yale. They made an offer to him, and he said, "Would I have to teach?" They said, "Yes." He said, "No." But anyhow, the cyclotron was almost invented at Yale. But they have a cyclotron, which, as you can see, generates 19 MeV protons, which can collide with a water target of H2O18, a special oxygen isotope, to produce 18 fluoride. So they can generate this stuff with their accelerator, right? And then if you look on the web page, you can see that they have in their laboratory, they have two F18 synthesis modules, things that they can do syntheses to make these into compounds. One of them is a nucleophilic substitution box, so that's what we're talking about. So what to synthesize? Okay, so you've got this fluorine 18 inorganic that you've made, a salt, and you have to convert it as quickly as possible into something that's going to go where a tumor is. Okay, so glucose is a good thing to go where tumors are, because tumors are growing very rapidly, so they suck up glucose, so they'll concentrate it. Now, glucose doesn't have fluorine in it, right? But if you'd substituted this OH group by fluorine 18, then this might go the same place that is. You might be able to fool the tumor's attraction of things so that it'll attract this instead. So let's try to make that. Well, that looks quite straightforward. All we have to do is do an SN2 substitution, replacing the OH by F18. Right or wrong? Or can you see any problems with this? Well, Derek, what's one problem? Okay, one problem is you've got to get one specific OH group. Okay, any other problems?
That seems very unstable.
This seems unstable?
Yeah.
Well, it's unstable in the sense that the fluorine is going to decay. That's give off a positron. But it's not chemically unstable. It's a perfectly stable compound. Yeah. Pardon me?
There's no...
There's no room to attack? Is that what you said?
Right.
Okay, attack on cyclohexyl is slower than on this is six-membered ring, right? Attack on cyclohexyl is slower than cyclopentyl. We talked about that last time. But it's not drastically slower. It's an order of magnitude or something like that. Sagar? Pardon me? No, remember, bases don't attack ether. The way you attack ether is with HBr. You protonate to make a good leaving group and then have a good nucleophile, bromide. That's, in fact, a hint that bromide is a good nucleophile. Are you using bromide? Henry? Fluoride is a crummy nucleophile, right? So, and OH minus is a horrid leaving group. So we got a horrid leaving group. We could easily attack the wrong carbon, right? And if you do an SN2 reaction, you get inversion, and you get that doesn't look as much like glucose and might not do the trick. Ryan?
Do we really care which hydroxyl group is?
You might imagine having a mixture of them, right? So maybe that's not a problem. But these are still, but these other things are still problems. And the fluoride is a terrible nucleophile. It's tied up by hydrogen bonding, and it's also tied up by being tightly associated with the potassium cation. So fluoride is a horrid nucleophile. So you got a horrid nucleophile, a horrid leaving group, you get the wrong compound, and you might attack the wrong COH. So this is a bad recipe for doing a reaction in high yield with this really expensive stuff fast. So what can we do about it? How about the fact that inversion gives the wrong configuration if the other one here is what we want to get? what do? Start with a different sugar, right? So we start with it, so that one's awful. But if we started with mannose instead of glucose, which is the configurational isomer at this carbon, then if we do the SN2 reaction, we'll get the right thing. Okay, so all we have to do is use mannose instead of glucose. That was turned out not to be much of a problem. Okay, now how about these other problems? How about that the wrong COH could be attacked, right? What you can do if you want to convert mannose to the 2-fluoroglucose as soon as possible is you can do this reaction, which we'll talk about, I hope, later on toward the end of the course, that's well known for sugars, which can make ester groups out of all these oxygens, but leave that one alone. So that acetate is called a protecting group because it protects a group while you do a reaction someplace else, keeps it from reacting. You do the reaction, and then you take the protecting group off again. So acetate can work that way. So that's no problem. That's well known. Okay, so we don't have to worry about that. And also, there's a byproduct of this. If you convert these OHs into esters, then they can't hydrogen bond anymore. So at least you don't have to worry about them tying up the fluoride. There might be other OHs, yeah, but not at least those. Pardon me?
Why doesn't the acetate bond with the OH that's sticking up?
Well, we might talk about that later. I'll tell you the idea that this OH was in fact protected at the time you put these on. The reason was it was connected to this one. Okay? So you put these on while that one's protected, then you deprotect this one. Right? And so on. It's a little complicated, which is why I didn't go into it. But I hope we'll have time to talk about it later on. Yeah.
Why is mannose with the OH sticking up immune to the configurational issues that we had with?
Oh no, the configuration problem was we want to get this pointing down. So if it comes in and the leaving group leaves from the other side of the carbon, the leaving group must have had to be pointing up, right? And that's what it is in mannose. In glucose, it would have been the wrong way. Did I not understand your question?
So when it reacts, then it'll...
Yeah, if this is the leaving group, it's a horrid leaving group. But if this were the leaving group, then the nucleophile would come in from the bottom and displace it. So the product would have it on the bottom, which is what you want. Okay? Okay, so now we got to deal with this problem of OH minus being a horrid leaving group. Any ideas for that? Why? You could protonate it, but it turns out that protonation will also remove the esters. You're going to use that later on for that purpose. So you need some other way of making this into a leaving group other than just a proton. Can anything else do that? Is there any other way of making OH minus into a leaving group, changing the OH into something else other than just protonating it? Shows I've been talking too fast. The last 5 slides were on that, how to put sulfur on there, phosphorus on there, and so on, right? Kenyon and Phillips did it. Okay? And so that's the same trick you use. It's very like Kenyon and Phillips, right? You're putting SO2 in place of the H. And Kenyon and Phillips had a phenyl group there. In this case, you use trifluoromethyl. What might be good about having a lot of fluorines in there? They're very electron withdrawing, so they stabilize anions, right? So that'll make it even a better anion to leave than had it been phenyl here, or toluene the way it was in Kenyon and Phillips cases. So this is a common leaving group. It's called trifluoromethane sulfonate, trifluoromethane sulfonate with the oxygen there, or triflate. So that's commonly used. Okay, so that makes the OH into a really good leaving group, so we don't have to worry about that. But we still have to worry about the fluoride being tied up by hydrogen bonding, right? So we want to react now with the stuff that came from the accelerator, the K plus F18, not 18 negative charges, but F18 anion, okay? So what are you going to choose for a solvent? Water sound good? Brian? Why not water?
water wouldn't dissolve the...
That's a good point. I suspect that you're right that that's not soluble in water. But there's an even greater problem that's already listed here. You get lots of H bonding with water that's going to tie up the fluoride and make it impossible to function as a nucleophile. So what are you going to use? You're going to use an aprotic solvent. Right, something that won't hydrogen bond with it. Now, notice the crown ether will help the cation. You want something that'll make things come away from the anion, the OH minus. Right? So you use a dipolar, so it'll dissolve the salt, aprotic solvent so that it won't do it. So they used acetonitrile, as it's called, which is an aprotic solvent. So you don't have it tied up by, there are no hydrogens on here, hydrogen bonding hydrogens, there's no hydrogen bonding the solvent, so that's good. But you still have the problem that it's being stabilized by the potassium cation. I'm going to return to you, Brian. What can you do to get the cation away? Ah, now you use your crown ether. Okay, so pull the potassium ion further away so the fluoride is really hot, and now it does the reaction really quickly, right? And then you use acid to take off the acetate groups, and you got it. So you can do these two red steps really quickly. You have this already. Then you turn on your accelerator and make this stuff. Then you add that solvent and so on, and zing again, and you got it really quickly. Yeah.
When you use that solvent, isn't there the potential for the lone pair of that nitrogen to attack one of the CF orbitals in SO, the CLS or 2CF?
Yeah, you could imagine the unshared pair on the nitrogen being a good nucleophile, but it's not so good because it has high S character. It's very low energy. It's not a good. It's not a high HOMO. The unshared pair on. I mean, it can be attacked, but it's not nearly as good a nucleophile as other things would be.
So there's no real risk of any of the Fs on the SO2-CF dissociating and then that?
No. The CF bond is very strong, right? The F is a horrid leaving group. We showed that before, too. F minus is a horrid leaving. So here's an example of an application of it taken from last year's textbook. And here's somebody's lungs, and there's where there's a tumor. And you see how it lit up in this thing. So it works. But you have to operate really quickly by optimizing the SN2 reaction. Okay, now just in passing, I'll have office hours in my office, 181 SCL, this afternoon from 3 to 4:30 if anybody needs to talk about things that are going along before the exam next Wednesday. And I'll also be giving a review session on Monday evening, 7 to 9. Okay, so we've looked at using stereochemistry rate law, rate constants. The last thing we're going to look at is structure, how X-ray might help us with this, and quantum mechanics. So we've been beating up on the dissociation-association mechanism, the idea of having a trivalent carbon intermediate, even though there are reactions which do that, but not the ones we're talking about. Okay, but a much tougher problem to decide is to distinguish between a concerted reaction and the association-dissociation in the case where the intermediate is not very stable. And there's a supplementary reading on the website about this, what I'm going to be talking about now. So might there be a pentavalent intermediate instead of a concerted transition state? But you can, so there's the transition state, and there would be the pentavalent intermediate. And the reaction coordinate diagram would look like that for a transition state where you just go over one. And there'd be two transition states for the pentavalent intermediate. But if the intermediate has very low stability, then this can blend into that. And you can imagine it would be very difficult to do experiments that could truly distinguish between them. Okay, that's the problem we're going to talk about now. Well, you can try it with quantum mechanics. So people did high-level quantum mechanics to get the best structure for having two waters next to C with three methyl groups as a cation, and that found that there's not a stable structure. This is a maximum in energy along the reaction path, not a minimum. It's a transition state. And they did the same thing using two OH minuses. with CH3+, and found that this structure also was a transition state. There is no dimple at the top, according to quantum mechanics. But quantum mechanics has a hard time matching solvent, and furthermore, neither of these specific reactions is practical in the laboratory. You can't do a real experiment to test these predictions. Okay, so what could you do instead? What kind of experiments might you be able to do? How about X-ray? Could we do X-ray to see whether there's such a structure, to see whether we could get a structure here? The problem is that neither of those things is stable. You can't get a crystal to study. Okay. Now, what we would like to have is a crystal structure that has a nucleophile, C+, and a leaving group, another nucleophile, all arranged like that, and find out whether they're bonded to each other. That's the question. Are both groups bonded? Okay. Now, here's an example of exactly that. Here's an oxygen with its lone pair, another oxygen with its lone pair, and a carbon in the middle, which is attached to two O methyls, right? So that would be carbon plus in the middle. And the question is, if you have that, are there bonds across there? But an even more fundamental question is, how do you get them to arrange like that if it's not a very stable structure? And the way it was done was to hold in place, hold them in that arrangement by adding more to the molecule, like this. So have those three groups attached to this planar framework, right? So they have to be in those positions, and then find out whether they're bonds. Okay? So it started with this, where you have a carbonyl group there. That's that group. So now we want to put another methyl on there, in fact methyl plus, in order to have this become C+. So what they used was this so-called Mervyn's reagent analog. The Mervyn's reagent is triethyl oxonium fluoroborate. What they used was trimethyl oxonium fluoroborate. So here's, you can do a nucleophilic substitution reaction up here where this attacks and the leaving group is a positive oxygen. Okay, so now you've got the positive charge on the carbon. So they took that compound, reacted it with that, and now they've got the cation. And of course, it's a salt, the anion. You'd expect to be BF4-, because that was the counter ion. In fact, just although this is pretty much irrelevant, when they did the crystal structure, they found that another BH3 had gotten into the act and associated with BF4. So the anion was a little different. But that's not really relevant to the story. I just tell you that because it's real. Okay, so this is the compound that they determine the crystal structure of. Now, remember in this case, it said it was a transition state, that these things were not real bonds. Okay, so the question is, are there bonds in this experimental example? Well, this is the picture they drew in there of their X-ray structure, and you can see that there are bonds there. Right or wrong? Yeah, Brian?
How do we know for the structures on the right and left that they're not like inverted?
The right here?
Yeah. Like,
what do you mean inverted?
It's like the other way.
You mean where? I'm not sure in what sense it would invert. This is an oxygen which is bound to three things, right?
Oh.
Okay. And this is an oxygen which is, normally it would be CO methyl. Right, but there's a bond here. But of course, where did that bond come from? How did they know there was a bond there? But what did they find out by X-ray? Did they find out? They found out where the nuclei are, and then they just drew bonds. So just drawing it doesn't make it a bond, right? Okay, so the question is that a bond? Or even a more subtle question, might this carbon sometimes be associated with this oxygen, other times be associated with this oxygen, be bouncing back and forth, and all you see is the average, right? Could it be like this sometimes and like that sometimes? If it were that, then what you would see for that electron distribution around that would be an ellipse, elongated in this direction. But it's not an ellipse. It's no bigger a sphere than all these others. These ellipsoids here show how much the atoms are vibrating, right? And this one isn't vibrating any more than any of the others. So it is indeed in the middle. It's not just averaging by vibrating back and forth. But there's still the question of whether they're bonds. So turn the molecule a little bit to look right on the edge of it. And how do we know whether they're bonds there? One way would be to do electron difference density, but that requires really high precision work, which was hard to do on this compound. The other way you know the bonds is by bond distance, right? Are the bond distances unusual? And look at that. The distance between these carbons is 5.02 angstroms, but the distance between those two is 4.86. It's shorter, as if the central atom is sucking them in. Okay? So it's shortened by 0.16 angstroms compared to this. So it looks like there's a pentavalent carbon in the middle that's attracting, that's pulling these things in, that's bonding to them, that it's stable. Okay? And notice here that it's bent in. This is bent in. This is 125 degrees. That's 113 degrees. Right? So a paper was published on this inferring that this is a pentavalent carbon. But unfortunately, somebody else noticed that if you have a hydrogen in the middle, this distance is even shorter. Right? The hydrogen isn't bonded to those two things. So it's bent in just as much. The distance is a little shorter. So forget that. Okay, it's not a... That's, now, what the heck is going on here? Right? Notice that there's other things attached that was attached to the central C+. But what caused it to bend in was this repulsion here bent it in. Not attraction from here, but repulsion from here is what caused those things to be close to one another, because it happens even when you have hydrogen. In fact, if you put oxygen there, which certainly doesn't bond to these things, right? Its orbitals are all full, and have extra stuff on there, right, which will tend to pull these apart, still it's not very long. It's only very slightly further apart than it was in the case of the carbon. There's what it was in the case of the carbon. Right? But now if you put BF2 in the middle, then it sucks it in. So BF2 seems to be able to make bonds to those two oxygens. Okay, where shorter than that. Okay, now if you make a stronger nucleophile, have these two things here, BO minus, and have the LUMO on the carbon be lower because you have fluorines withdrawing electron density, then it's better at bonding. But it's unsymmetrical. It bonds one way or the other. Right? It forms a bond on the left and not on the right. This, incidentally, is also biased by the fact that there's a cation around with this anion, and that helps keep this not bonded to that. Okay, so indeed, it appears that it's not that there is not normally bonding. So then there's this table, which we don't need to go through in great detail, but we can compare with these things where there's no question of forming a bond to the middle, and we find that in this case, the original one studied, that it's bonded, it seems that these what was attached here had oxygen, so there was a vacant orbital on carbon that should be attractive to those HOMOs. Right, but there were also unshared pairs on the oxygens that are bonded to it. Those unshared pairs are going to be stabilizing that, as shown by this resonance structure. So it's not such a low LUMO. So maybe it's not surprising it didn't form bonds. Oops, sorry. Now, if you put fluorine on instead of oxygens, then it can withdraw from the boron, and now you can get it to suck in. Right? But if you have higher neighbor HOMOs, they favor tetravalence, unsymmetrical, just forming one bond. Okay, so I'm not going to go through this because we've done it, but it just underlines the fact that in the case of boron, you can get there are some cases that are very different and unsymmetrical, some that are equal and symmetrical, that in hydrogen, the reference, which is non-bonded, they're about the same. Boron seems to have loose association. These seem to be perhaps bonded, but not very strongly. But the cases of carbon are either either not bonded, not short, or if it's bonded, one of them's very short and the other's very long, so it's not pentavalent. So the conclusion is there's no sign for stability of pentavalent SN2 intermediate. That implies that it's a transition state as calculated by quantum mechanics. So this was a lot of work just to show that there probably isn't a little dimple up at the top, that it really is just the kind of mechanism we've been talking about. Okay, we'll stop here for today.